So if you've been here then on Sunday mornings over recent months, you'll know that in Exodus chapters 25 to 30, God set out the instructions that he wanted Moses and the Israelites to follow in constructing the tabernacle. Now in chapters 36 verse 8 to 40 verse 33, most of our passage this morning, we have the description of that actually happening, Moses and the Israelites indeed following the instructions for constructing the tabernacle. And they follow them very, very closely, which of course is admirable. But it means that what we have in these chapters is largely just a repetition of what we had in those earlier instructions. There it was, make this thing and this thing and this thing. Here in our passage this morning, it's they made this thing and this thing and this thing. And because of that repetitive element then, we're not going to work through these final chapters in the way that we normally would. We've already talked about the tabernacle's design and furniture when the instructions were being given. We don't need to talk about the tabernacle's design and furniture again now that the instructions are being followed. But while not requiring detailed exposition, these chapters do, I think, merit one sermon at least. Because surely the question needs to be asked and answered, why are they here at all? Why are they here? Why not just a single sentence to the effect Moses and the Israelites followed the instructions for the tabernacle, which God had given on Mount Sinai? Wouldn't that be enough? I mean, apart from challenging our patience and our concentration skills, what does this material in our passage this morning do, really? What purpose does it serve? Well, here are three answers to that question. First of all, it creates confidence. It creates confidence. So Moses, of course, is the author of this material. And as he writes these chapters that we're looking at now, he's not now transmitting God's words. That's what he was doing, of course, in chapters 25 to 30. All those instructions for the construction of the tabernacle, they were directly from God. In writing those six chapters, Moses was simply transmitting God's words spoken to him on Sinai. These chapters, by contrast, are his own report of the tabernacle's actual construction, in the same way that a sports journalist in a match report gives his or her account of a game of football, in the same way that a burgled homeowner in a victim statement gives his or her account of a crime, Moses here gives his account of that special tent structure being put together. I'm saying he's not in relayer mode in these chapters, just mechanically, impersonally relaying stuff from God. No, he's in observer mode. He's observing what's going on, and he's telling us what's going on here in these chapters. And that being so, the thorough, exhaustive nature of this material tells us surely what kind of man Moses is. It tells us that he's not a dreamy, flighty, head in the clouds kind of guy. Okay, I know he does literally have his head in the clouds quite a bit of the time when he's on Sinai, but that's not what I mean. He isn't one of those people that you come across sometimes, don't you, who live in a world of angels and miracles and all kinds of mystical goings on, but who are hopelessly vague when it comes to facts and figures in the ordinary everyday world. No, the man who writes this report is clearly meticulous and precise. Way more interested, it seems, in providing an accurate account than in providing a scintillating read. Just by its very existence, these chapters of blow-by-blow commentary, just by their very existence, featuring detail after detail, feature after feature of the tabernacle, just by their very existence, they tell us that Moses is meticulous and precise. But two things particularly highlight Moses' meticulousness and precision. First is that section I read, the first section I read, chapter 38, verses 21 to 31. And in these verses, Moses really does go the extra mile. He informs us here of the exact quantities of gold, silver, and bronze that were used in this tabernacle construction project. Now, that is superfluous information. We don't need to know that. Moses doesn't really need to know that. All anyone needs to know is that there was enough of these metals to construct everything that God wanted to be constructed. And whether enough gold meant this amount, or whether enough gold meant that amount, well, who really cares about that? Well, Moses obviously does. We're told in verse 21 of how he commanded records to be made. I was listening to an interview the other day with Martin Lewis, the financial journalist who's often on the BBC giving advice on how to use your money and that kind of thing. And he was commenting in this interview on his obsession with spreadsheets. He has spreadsheets for everything, even the number of steps that he does each day. He has a spreadsheet for that. He just has this insatiable appetite for statistical data. And Moses seems to be wired up in that way too. He isn't content with being able to report enough of the different materials. He must have the exact figures, the exact quantities at his fingertips. And then the second thing to highlight in this connection is the order of construction in Moses' reports. You see, when God gave his instructions to Moses there on Mount Sinai, God was more interested in the tabernacle's theological significance than he was in its construction logistics. And so he began, you may remember, with the items of furniture inside the tabernacle, which of course are so rich in meaning and which afford all kinds of windows into the heart of God and into the gospel of Jesus Christ ultimately. He first instructed Moses about those, about the items of furniture in the tabernacle, and only later he came to the tabernacle's curtains, which are far more functional, just partitions really, separating indoor area from outdoor area, room from room. So that was God's order. Moses, however, is simply reporting the tabernacle's construction. And of course, just as in today's construction projects, external shells precede internal features, so in this construction project, the curtains would have preceded the ark being made and the table being made and the lampstand being made. The curtains would have been made first. And so that's the order in Moses' account. As our passage gets going in chapter 36, verse 8, it's the curtains, you'll notice, that he immediately starts talking about. So his order is not the order that God had employed in the instructions on Mount Sinai. Because Moses, you see, is just giving a straightforward, factual report of this thing being made. And nothing will deflect him from that. And he won't allow theological considerations to interfere with observational accuracy. Just setting out events in a plain and guileless manner, that is what Moses is all about. Now, why am I making such a big thing of the meticulousness and precision that Moses exhibits in these chapters? Well, for this reason. You can trust an author like that. You can trust an author like that. And when that same author then writes about plagues afflicting the land of Egypt, and about a path being created through the middle of a sea, and about edible bread-like stuff materializing on the desert floor every morning, and about a bush that burned without being consumed, and about a visible aerial phenomenon that was cloud by day and fire by night, in those instances, we can't say, oh, well, he's just using artistic license. Or, look, he's just getting a bit carried away. Or, oh, he's having one of his flights of fancy. Because that's just not the kind of guy that Moses is. An author prone to using artistic license and having flights of fancy does not write Exodus chapters 36 to 40. The man who writes these chapters is wedded to accurately, methodically reporting things almost to the point of being irritating. And a sudden foray by that author into fantasy, a sudden insertion of a sea-crossing myth here and a burning bush fairy tale there in order to make his book a bit more racy, that's just not plausible. And that's what I mean then when I say that this material in our passage this morning, it creates confidence. It creates confidence in the reliability of everything else which Moses writes. And you know, that same logic can be applied again and again throughout the Bible. Not least, it can be applied to the four Gospels at the beginning of our New Testaments. The more I've read the Gospels as I've gone on in my Christian life, the more I've come to love the bits that as a child you're really little aware of. All the place names, all the passing political references, who was governing where and who was serving as chief priest when. All the biographical details about Anna's tribal roots and about Joanna's husband's job. None of that stuff is strictly necessary. And you might think that if it were edited out so that all we had were the juicy bits about the virgin birth and the resurrection and the healing miracles, then the Gospels really would be page turners. But actually, the loss of those little details would leave the Gospels immeasurably impoverished. As I say, I love those details. I love them because they show me that the writers cared about facts. The writers cared about being meticulous and precise. And that's why I can believe their reports of a virgin birth and a resurrection on the third day and healing miracles and all the rest of it. Because men prepared to risk boring me with facts and figures that I don't need are not fantasists. They are men who will only tell me that a carpenter from Nazareth once rose from the dead, if that is exactly what the evidence forced them to conclude. So what does this material in our passage this morning do? Well, in the first place, it creates confidence. It creates confidence that the man who wrote this can be believed in all the other stuff that he wrote. But secondly, notice with me, it demonstrates delight. That's the second thing this material in our passage does. It demonstrates delight. So we've talked about Moses as the author of Exodus, but of course the book has another author too. God, in the last analysis, is the author of Exodus, and God, therefore, is the author of these chapters that we are thinking about. Now, if Moses' motive for including these chapters is that he's just a meticulous and precise kind of guy, what's God's? What's God's motive for including these chapters? Well, I think that one phrase particularly uncovers for us God's motive. It's a phrase that's used over and over again in this passage, especially in chapters 39 and 40, and it's the phrase, as the Lord had commanded. As the Lord had commanded. I'll not show you every occurrence, that would take far too long. There are so many of them. But I'll just flag up for you chapter 39, verses 42 and 43, because that's particularly emphatic. We read there, according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses, so the people of Israel had done all the work. And Moses saw all the work, and behold, they had done it. As the Lord had commanded, so had they done it. So that epitomizes the whole of this passage, this stress on the Israelites having obeyed God's instructions. And this is the thing. God delights in this obedience his people have shown in constructing the tabernacle. And that's why he wants to go slowly through it, detail by detail. their obedience with regard to this part of the structure and their obedience with regard to that part of the structure. Because it thrills him. And he wants to relish it and to savour it and to shout about it to all who will read this book. The inclusion of these chapters, I'm saying, demonstrates delight. It demonstrates delight in the heart of God himself. And that gives rise to two thoughts. First of all, God is always like that regarding his people's obedience. God is always like that regarding his people's obedience. A few weeks ago, you may remember, on a Sunday evening, I preached on Luke 17, just a one-off sermon, and I did so particularly with a view to dispelling a common understanding of that phrase, "We are unworthy servants." You know those four words that are used there in Luke 17, "We are unworthy servants." And I tried to show then that those words are used there because of something specific that's going on in that passage. And my concern in preaching that sermon is that many Christians, I feel, have an idea of God's evaluation of them derived from that verse in Luke 17. They assume God is constantly unimpressed with their obedience. That when they obey his commands, he basically responds to them, "Well, I should jolly well think you have obeyed my commands." Indeed, they imagine him on the one hand to be dismissive and unnoticing of their acts of obedience, and then on the other hand to be ever brooding resentfully on their acts of disobedience. But the book of Exodus smashes those ideas to smithereens. Remember last week we talked about the two construction projects that so attract kind of comparison and contrast, don't they? The two construction projects at the foot of Sinai. Now, think of it. One of those construction projects is characterized by disobedience, monstrous, stinking disobedience, the making of that golden calf. And God, the author of this book, devotes one chapter to it. The other construction project is characterized by obedience, the making of this tabernacle. And what does the divine author do? He devotes around 5 chapters to it. Those are the proportions. One chapter on the disobedience, the stinking disobedience of the golden calf. 5 chapters where again and again we have that glowing phrase, "As the Lord had commanded, as the Lord had commanded, as the Lord had commanded." No yes buts. Yes, but you didn't behave like that the other week, did you? When Moses was on top of the mountain and you went to Aaron with your request. No snide remarks of that kind. "Oh, it's good to see you using your stuff now for the right kind of project." No, just this glowing material. "As the Lord had commanded, as the Lord had commanded, as the Lord had commanded." Does it not just reinforce what we said several weeks ago now about the significance of the incense in the tabernacle and the way in which the incense speaks of God's acceptance of the prayers but also of the obedient lives of his people? God finds it sweet-smelling and beautiful and attractive when his people pray to him and when his people just live out their ordinary lives serving him faithfully. And you see that written across these chapters, I'm saying. "As the Lord had commanded, as the Lord had commanded," and the Lord then wanting the whole thing to be rehearsed blow by blow because he's so delighting in his people's obedience. And I say to you again this morning, as I said to you when preaching on the incense, that's how he regards our Christian obedience. Not in a surly, resentful manner. "Oh, you're just an unworthy servant. I should hope you have done that." But he regards our obedience as incense that delights him and thrills him. And he wants to talk about it detail by detail. I suspect the angels get fed up with him talking about the obedience of his people. I suspect the angels are going to be rather disappointed when we finally meet them. They probably have an inflated view of us because the Lord is constantly speaking of our obedience. And they'll meet us and we don't quite live up to the reputation that they've been given. Because that's the kind of God we have, a God who delights in the obedience of his people. So God is always like this regarding his people's obedience. The other thought that arises here is this: God is supremely like that regarding his son's obedience. God is supremely like that regarding his son's obedience. Remember the River Jordan? Again, the Mount of Transfiguration. This is my son with whom I am well pleased. The father is so proud of his son's obedience. And at the Jordan and even at the Mount of Transfiguration, the climax of that obedience is still some way off. What is the father like at Calvary itself when his son is obeying him even to death on a cross? What pleasure, what pride must fill the father's heart as he looks on his obedient son then. And you remember the logic of that famous passage, we all know it, Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 to 11. And we know that passage, as I say, and we know how the first half of that hymn that Paul cites there, the first half concerns Christ's humiliation, and then how in the second half of that hymn, there's the stuff about every knee bowing to Christ and every tongue confessing that he is Lord. We're aware of all that. What we perhaps aren't so aware of is the connection between the two halves. And the crucial little words, the little connecting words that Paul uses. So remember, he talks about Christ being obedient to the point of death, Philippians 2:8, even death on a cross. Verse 9, therefore God has highly exalted him. So because he obeyed so magnificently, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow. And you see what's going on there. The point is that the son has obeyed his father so stupendously, so perfectly, so magnificently, that there is now this proud father, his heart bursting that everybody should recognize and acknowledge this son of his who has obeyed him so perfectly. And I say to you this morning, that's why it is such a scary thing to live your whole life and never bow the knee to Jesus Christ. It's a very scary thing to turn up on Judgment Day having consistently refused to bow the knee to Jesus Christ. God will take that very badly. He will say, "This son of mine, he did that. He obeyed me so beautifully. He could have called on the angels at any minute to come and rescue him, and he refused, and he went through Gethsemane, through the trial, through the whipping, through the stripping, through the mocking, through the hell of dereliction at the ninth hour, through the death, the burial. He went through all of that for me, obeying me. And you think nothing of that. And you've disregarded my obedient son and bowed the knee to your career or to your football team or to whoever it was instead." God will take that very badly. Don't be found on that judgment day as someone turning up with an unbowed knee. Make sure you're someone who turns up that day as a worshipper of the Son in whom the Father is well pleased. So this material then, in our chapters this morning. I'm saying, what does it do? Well, it creates confidence. It demonstrates delight. But then thirdly and finally, it indicates importance. It indicates importance. Clearly, if the tabernacle then, when you add up the instructions on Sinai and the actual implementation of those instructions, if the tabernacle takes up maybe 11 chapters or something altogether, it must be pretty important, mustn't it? Why is it so important? Well, we could answer that from various different angles, but let me just answer it as I close in this way. The tabernacle meant that the Israelites could move on from Sinai. The tabernacle meant that the Israelites could move on from Sinai. You probably think that in this sermon series we've been at Sinai forever. Actually, we haven't been as long at Sinai in this sermon series as the Israelites were at Sinai. It seems from the dating that we have in the book of Exodus that they were at Sinai for 9 months. We're told in chapter 40, verse 17, that it was the first month in the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was erected. We know from Exodus 12:12 that their whole time and system began with the Passover. So the Exodus from Egypt was the beginning of their first year. The tabernacle is finished at the beginning of their second year. So it's a year after they left Egypt. But we know from chapter 19, verse 1, they took 3 months to get to Sinai. So you minus 3 months and you're left with 9 months. 9 months the Israelites are at Sinai. And while Sinai was initially terrifying to the Israelites, I'm sure that over time it had become something of a comforting reality to be camped beside this mountain where God's presence conspicuously resides. I'm sure that they felt safe because of that, safe in a context in which ostensibly they were pretty vulnerable, just camped there in the wilderness where any passing nomadic tribes could come and attack them. I'm sure it gave them a sense of security being camped beside this mountain where God's presence so conspicuously resided. And moving on from that then after 9 months is a pretty daunting prospect. It's unknown territory that they're now going into. It's uncharted waters. But notice in this connection those final verses of the whole book that we did read earlier on. Chapter 40, verses 34 to 38. And there are two striking things in those verses. First of all, the emphasis on the cloud. I think the cloud is mentioned in each one of those verses. Repeatedly, the cloud is mentioned. So the tabernacle is, of course, what has been talked about here. The tabernacle is now finished, but the cloud covers the tabernacle, verse 34, and settles on it, verse 35, and so on. And then the other striking thing, as well as the emphasis on the cloud, is the emphasis on Moses being unable to enter the tabernacle, unable to enter until he's called by the Lord, which happens in the first verse of Leviticus, Leviticus 1:1. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. Now, both those details then, the emphasis on the cloud, the emphasis on Moses being unable to enter until called, they are highly reminiscent of Sinai. One verse in particular brings that out, and that's chapter 24, verse 16. And there we read, the glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. So there you have the cloud on Mount Sinai. And on the seventh day, so after 6 days of being unable to enter, he, that's the Lord, called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. So you have the same concept there that we have here. Moses unable to enter until being called by the Lord. So you have, I'm saying, the tabernacle being talked of now at the end of the book of Exodus, but it's been spoken of in terms highly reminiscent of Sinai. Actually, there's a third striking feature of these verses, which is the emphasis on movement. So journeys are referenced in verse 36 and 38 throughout all their journeys. And then there's the phrase set out is mentioned twice also. So you have this sense of movement now, the Israelites moving on. And so you put all of that together then. And what do you have in these verses? Well, I think we're meant to understand you have the idea that Sinai is now going with them. Sinai is going with them. Now, not literally, of course. They're not going to have a mountain following them. But the point is that the God who resided with them at Sinai is going with them. And he's going with them now by means of the tabernacle. The tabernacle enables Sinai to go with them. And that's why then they can move on. They can move on into this unknown, into these uncharted waters. They can move on because Sinai is going with them. The God of Sinai is going with them. And he's going with them through this tabernacle. That's why the tabernacle is so important. It enables them to venture out into the unknown. Now, we as Christians in our individual lives, we have thresholds and turning points often, don't we, in our lives. Leaving home, perhaps, for the first time. Experiencing your children leaving home for the first time. Retirement. Widowhood. Leaving your home to go into care. Or into a hospice, perhaps. And those are big moments, big thresholds, daunting thresholds for us to cross in our lives. Big, like the Israelites here having to step out and leave Mount Sinai. And we wonder at those moments, can we cope? Can I cope with this new situation, this new chapter, this new stage of my life? Will I be okay the other side of this threshold? Can I cope moving on from a situation that I've been in for such a long time? And the answer then that the end of the book of Exodus is giving us is yes, you can move on. You can move on because the God of your last chapter will be the God of your next chapter. The God who has been with you in that stage will be with you in this stage. The God of that side of the threshold will be the God of the other side of the threshold too. Sinai will come as you step out. The God who was there for you, who helped you, who enabled you, who sustained you, he will still be with you. The circumstances may be utterly different in that new chapter, but the reality of a present God will be just the same. Perhaps you need to be encouraged in that regard this morning. Perhaps you're daunted, you're apprehensive because of some big transition that you're at the cusp of today. Be confident that everything that was really important in your last chapter will go with you into the next. Because what was really important was the God who held you by your hand. And he will hold you by your hand the next chapter and all the next chapters until finally you enter his presence. Amen.